Islamic laws. If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. دين الإسلام ديني والعظم غير ديني محمد إلي هديني. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of Hajj, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about Hajj according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas regarding Hajj and the jurisprudential laws
around it. Let me ask you this question. You know, are there any specific recommended acts or rituals that, Muslims should do or follow up, before embarking on a Hajj journey?
Well, there are some recommended acts and there are some obligatory acts that one should perform, should do.
Mm-hmm.
One, for example, if you are if you have an asset which you are going to use to perform Hajj,
right?
You need to purify that asset and whatever you have in your house. If a year has passed on your bank balance or on the property that you have,
right,
and you have not paid khums from that property, it is obligatory to perform and to give khums from the property, from the asset, or from your bank balance that you have, if a year has passed over the asset or the capital that you possess. You cannot perform Hajj if you do not or if you will not pay khums from the property or from the capital that you have saved over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
This is obligatory. And if you owe someone some money, you have to give it, you have to repay it, otherwise you cannot perform an obligatory Hajj. This is something mandatory, it's necessary. You cannot embark on an obligatory Hajj if you owe someone some money. That's it. And then when it comes to recommended things, of course, before you want to leave for Hajj,
right,
it is very much important and highly recommended that you go from door to door, from visit your relatives, friends, mm-hmm, and ask them for forgiveness. It's recommended based on the tradition and the hadith that we have received from our infallible imams and from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. It is recommended that you ask your friends and relatives,
mm-hmm,
to for forgiveness.
Right.
Forgiveness. And perhaps you might have hurt them, you might have physically, hurt them, you might have bothered them, they might be unhappy, they might be dissatisfied, or some kind of liabilities are there. And it's important that before embarking on a hard journey, you turn to them and ask them for forgiveness. That's very important.
I see. What about the recommended acts that you need to do as a Muslim coming back from the pilgrimage after Hajj,
Yeah.
Are there any specific, again, acts that, recommended to those people who took the trouble and the trip from Mecca?
The recommended thing is that he who comes or arrives back home, it is better that he gives people a feast.
Right.
As a feast is recommended. And it should be a handsome, a good, an affordable one. It should not be very much rich in terms of quality and mm-hmm, quantity, because it should be modest. Islam does not encourage or does not endorse
or
advocate or condone to kind of wastefulness.
Mm, yes.
Extravagance is not permissible in Islam.
Right.
So giving a feast is recommended. But of course, more important than giving a feast is to maintain your spirituality after
right,
the Hajj.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's he who performs the pilgrimage of the house of God, of Allah, of course, he is, according to the reports, he is purified from all sins. And he should live a clean, a pure, and a decent life. He should not indulge in things which are, which may be haram and which might pollute his soul, and might destroy his spirituality.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and newly asked questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the jurisprudential rules of Hajj according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, since it's a couple of episodes that we are speaking about this important ritual in Islam, I mean Hajj, the pilgrimage to the house of God, what are the different types of Hajj? Let's put it out actually to our dear audience.
Very good question. Well, there are, first of all, I should say that there are different types of Hajj. The most important Hajj which people predominantly and mostly, of course, perform is Hajjatul Islam, or what is called Hajj At-Tamattu. This is the Hajj which is obligatory for people who leave out of the premise of Mecca, who leave at least 90, who leave out of the vicinity of Mecca, okay? So people who perform, who live within 90 kilometers from Mecca, they are supposed to perform Hajj Qiran or Hajj Ifrat. So we have different types of Hajj, Hajj Tamattu, which is called Hajjatul Islam, and we have Hajj Qiran, Hajj Ifrat. And then we have Hajj Umrah, okay?
Right.
Umrah Mufrada. But generally speaking, people also call Umrah as Hajj, okay? Because
right.
those people who perform pilgrimage of the house of God, they are generally, you know, believed to be perform Hajj. You know, while they perform different types of Hajj. Maybe if I travel, for example, to Mecca in the month of Rajab or Sha'ban, for example, mm-hmm. I cannot perform Hajj Tamattu or the obligatory Hajj. What I can do is Umrah Mufrada, okay?
Mm.
And Umrah Mufrada is not obligatory. But of course, if I wear the ihram, if I go to Mecca, I have to wear the ihram and perform it. It becomes mm-hmm. obligatory.
I see.
If I am...
Once you're there.
Yeah, once I'm there, yes. So that's called Umrah. And of course, we have Hajjatul Islam, which starts with Umrah. The first thing that you should do is Umrah, okay? Umrah begins from Ihram, from Miqat, and then it will continue until you finish it with Sa'i between Safa and Marwa, and then finally the Taqsir, the clipping of your nails or hair, or shortening your hair. That's called Taqsir.
What about those people you said that live within 90 kilometer vicinity of Mecca?
Of Mecca, of course. Those
do they have to go to Hajj every year? Is it obligatory for them?
No, it's not obligatory because, you know, now there are of course, limitations. You know, the government will not allow...
A number limit.
Yeah.
A ration.
Sure. The Saudi government will not allow all Saudis to take part in the Hajj pilgrimage because it will get
congested,
overcrowded.
Overcrowded.
It will become dangerous. So even Saudi Arabia has to stick to the poor, to the ration, okay?
Yes.
And then people who live within 90 kilometers from the Mecca, from the Kaaba, should perform Qiran or Ifrad, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's no Umrah before Qiran and Ifrad.
Is it obligatory for them, like, at least once
of
in their lifetime?
Yeah, why not?
Like the Hajj Tamattu.
Yeah, once in a lifetime, they should perform because it is their Hajj. And of course, the rules regarding the rules of Hajj, Qiran, and Ifrad are slightly different because Qiran and Ifrad do not have Umrah. They are not supposed to start their Hajj with Umrah. Of course, Umrah is an independent Hajj for them.
Yes.
They can do it next year or maybe sometimes before it. But what they are supposed to do is go straight to Mecca and perform Qiran or Ifrat. They should make the niyyah of Qiran or Ifrat. So the names are different, you know.
Yes.
But when it comes to performing Hajj Tamattu and Hajj Qiran and Ifrat, they are the same, okay? They mm-hmm. should, for example, the wukuf is there, staying there at Arafat, Muzdalifah, and then Rami, stoning the Jamarat, and then doing the Sa'i and Safa, and then Tawaf, and then...
The procedures stay the same.
The procedure is the same, but the names are
different.
Different.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers and contribution to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
In the limelight. In a powerful warning on Thursday, 16th of June, the patron saint of the conservative legal movement, former federal appellate judge J. Michael Luttig, testified before the January 6th committee and pronounced former President Donald J. Trump and his allies a clear and present danger to American constitutional democracy. The article you're about to hear is an opinion editorial published by the Los Angeles Times. It has been written by Lawrence H. Tribe, a professor emeritus of constitutional law at Harvard University, Philip Allen Lacovara, a former deputy solicitor general of the United States and counsel to the Watergate special prosecutor who argued the case of United States versus Nixon, and Dennis Aftergut, a former federal prosecutor. The article is titled, "The Insurrection Won't End Until Trump is Prosecuted and Disqualified from Future Office." In a powerful warning on Thursday, 16th of June, the patron saint of the conservative legal movement, former federal appellate judge J. Michael Luttig, testified before the January 6th committee and pronounced former President Donald J. Trump and his allies a clear and present danger to American constitutional democracy. As Judge Luttig knows better than most, this historic phrase generates an extraordinary constitutional power of government to act and a duty to do so. Judge Luttig's verdict should be understood as a plea for Attorney General Merrick Garland to proceed towards charging Donald Trump with federal crimes that the public record now amply establishes. Only then will this nation be able to move forward from the ongoing insurrection. Beyond the avalanche of documents and testimony pointing to Donald Trump's guilt and the principle that no one is above the law, there is an additional reason to indict Donald Trump for his multifaceted conspiracy in 2020 to override the vote. Upon a conviction for inciting insurrection or being an accessory to insurrection, Trump would be subject to disqualification from acquiring federal office. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment directs, "No person shall hold any office under the United States who, having previously taken an oath as an officer of the United States to support the Constitution, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same." There is ample evidence that Donald Trump's objective was the insurrection's success. Among that evidence was his three-hour delay in calling the attackers to go home and his vengeful tweet demeaning Vice President Mike Pence, after Trump knew that the savage invasion of the U.S. Capitol had begun. "That was pouring gasoline on the fire," testified former Deputy White House Press Secretary Sarah Matthews. even without a direct charge of insurrection, allegations of such insurrectionist activities and an indictment for conspiring to defraud the United States or to obstruct the official proceeding of Congress or for seditious conspiracy might suffice for 14th Amendment disqualification if Trump were convicted. Holding Donald Trump accountable and disqualifying him from future office would not be a partisan act, but one needed to preserve the Republic. Without a prosecution of Donald Trump, here are three things that seem sure to happen if he were allowed to run again and either be lawfully elected or succeed in installing himself in office despite defeat in the Electoral College, as he attempted to do in 2020. 1. The end of elections in which a majority of American voters choose their leaders. As Judge J. Michael Luttig put it at Thursday's hearing, the clear and present danger now is because, to this very day, the former president and his allies and supporters pledged that in the presidential election of 2024, if the former president or his anointed successor as the Republican Party presidential candidate were to lose that election, they would attempt to overturn that 2024 election in the same way that they attempted to overturn the 2020 election. Republican-controlled state legislatures are already institutionalizing election sabotage, with GOP election officials determining election results no matter the vote winner. More than a dozen election deniers, like Jim Marchant, who just won the Republican primary for Secretary of State in Nevada, are GOP nominees for Secretary of State and other election-controlling positions. So even though Donald Trump won't hold the levers of presidential power in 2024 the way he did in 2020, he won't need to. His allies and his disinformation are putting officials in place around the country who will certify his win, whatever the vote. Two, the use of military for domestic control. The Trump administration deployed military helicopters in an unprecedented show of military force over peaceful demonstrators whom police attacked in Washington's Lafayette Park in July of 2020. Retired U.S. military leaders excoriated the abuse of power. In early December 2020, Donald Trump's close ally, his former National Security Advisor and retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, reportedly urged Trump to declare martial law in the United States. On 9th of November 2020, Donald Trump fired Defense Secretary Mark Esper and installed a more compliant Christopher Miller. On 4th of January 2021, Christopher Miller issued a memo requiring his approval to deploy the National Guard in Washington, D.C. On 6th of January 2021, Defense Department leadership delayed the National Guard's response to the Capitol siege by 3 hours. You don't have to be a clairvoyant to imagine how military force against political foes and restraint of force to protect violent supporters will be used if Donald J. Trump regains office. And three, the end of accountability. On 17th of June this year, in Nashville, Tennessee, Donald Trump said that if re-elected, he would consider very, very seriously pardoning all of the participants in the 6th of January insurrection. That could clear more than 310 insurrectionists who have pleaded guilty or been convicted at trial. Deterrence of future violence depends on judicially imposed sanctions, Donald Trump would remove them, signaling that violent extremism in defense of Trump is no vice. If he returns to the White House, he will install his people in the Justice Department and turn the machinery of prosecution against his political enemies and towards protecting his friends and his schemes. And should Donald Trump get an encore, look to pre-World War II Germany for a mirror. A failed coup d'etat in 1923 taught Adolf Hitler a better route to dictatorship just 9 years later. Those who repeat history are doomed to learn it the hard way.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. The house is primarily a nurturing place for adults rather than children. Most of us were unaware of our shortcomings and faults when we were single. However, when we get married, we could find them in our life. In better words, marriage helps us to find the solution to the problems that were once found in our single life. Through marriage, we can correct most of these problems.
خیلی از اوقات تا آدم مجرده نقطه ضعف‌های خودش رو خیلی خوب نمی‌دونه.
As long as we are single, we do not know our weak points. However, when we get married, we see easily our bad behaviors and deeds. For instance, we realize that we were stingy, suspicious, ruthless, or angry when single. When we become married, we can see these problems of ours more in comparison to the time that we were single. In fact, married life is a field of action. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. You're listening to the program The Teacher, which is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries and scholars. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Sheikh Ziyani, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we want to talk about an outstanding figure, Muslim authority, Shia religious authority of contemporary Iran, Sayyid Hussein Tabatabai Burujerdi, mainly known as the late Ayatollah Burujerdi, the custodian, it's better to say, of the Hauza Elmiya of Qom for 17 years, and for 15 years he was known as Marja al-Am, or the general public religious authority of the whole Shia world. But this time we can say he was residing in Iran and the holy city of Qom, unlike the others who were residing in Iraq. And we'll talk, of course, about this aspect of the life of Sayyid al-Burujerdi too. Okay, before getting to his achievements and his scholarly life, let's be more familiar with his early life. Sheikh Ziyani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life of Sayyid Hussein al-Burujerdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Hussein Burujerdi was born in 1292 in the city of Burujerd, a city in Iran. And that's why his name is also Tabatabai Burujerdi. And he is Sayyid. He is from the lineage of the Imam al-Hasan al-Mujtaba, alayhi salatu wassalam, with 32 generations in between. When he was 7 years old, he entered the school, and because he was a brilliant student and his father found that he is good in studies, the father sent him to Islamic Seminary of Burujerd, that was at that time Nurbakhsh Islamic Seminary. And after a year or two, he moved to Isfahan and continued his studies over there. And when he was 27, this is very important, he moved to Najaf and participated in the courses of late Ayatollah Akhund Khurasani, rahmatullah alayh, And 9 years he got benefit from the knowledge of Akhund Khorasani, a figure who is a dominant figure in Ilm al-Usul. And right. His book, Kifayat al-Usul, nowadays yes. is one of the most important books in Hawzat al-Ilmiyya.
Okay.
And we should mention also that Sayyid Kazim Yazdi, the mm-hmm. author of Urwatul Wuthqa, is yes. another teacher of late Ayatollah Burujerdi and late Marhum Shariat Isfahani Rahmatullah Alayhim Ajma'in. After residing in Najaf for some years, mm-hmm. he moved to Mashhad and resided in Mashhad for 8 months. That it is recorded, it was by the force of the king at that time in Iran, I mean Reza Shah, who was a really oppressor king.
Okay.
And after this, he moves to Burujerd, his mother city, and resides in Burujerd and decides to be the resident scholar of the city of Burujerd and giving services to the people of Burujerd.
Okay. Sheikh Mahdawi, what about his stay in the city of Qom? He becomes the source of benefit in the city of Qom, and then he becomes, we can say, the custodian of the Islamic seminary and the public religious authority of the whole Shiite world, and it is usually known that his most achievements happen in the city of Qom, isn't it?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is also said in his biography that when he was in Burujerd because of some medical issues, he was forced to move to Tehran. And while he was in Tehran, he receives the invitation of some of the great ulama of that time of Qom, including Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah alayhi, Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri, and also Sayyid Muhammad Muhaqqiq Damat. They are all inviting him to come to Qom and take over the leadership or the marja'iyya, because it was exactly after the demise of Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, the great marja, or might be called the marja ul-am of all of the Shia all around the world. So we see that Ayatollah Burujerdi, after the Sayyid Abul Hassan Burujerdi, is called the Marja ul-Am of all of the Shia. And interestingly, it was the first time to have the Alim who is taking this position from the Iran. So when he came to Qom, we see how ulama were collaborating with him and preparing the situation for him to take the actually chair for teaching or leading the Salat in the holy shrine of Hazrat Ma'asuma. Among his works, I think one of the very important works that before having access to these software, even recently most of the ulama would use and benefit from, is the Jama'ul Ahadith al-Shia. It's a kind of comprehensive, huge, voluminous book which contain many of the ahadith in actually a series of volume in this book.
Okay.
So right now, nowadays, since we have access to these softwares, we see the benefit of that volume in this book for the ulama who were who wanted to have access to the different ahadith.
So we say, when we say Jamal Ahadith, it means the Ahadith of Prophet Muhammad and the infallible Imams?
Yes, okay, yes, definitely. And also, Ayatollah Burujerdi is mainly known for his opinion of unity, bringing about all Islamic sects around one table. So we see in his time, although there were a lot of activities preceding this incident, but we see in his time, for the first time, we see Sheikh Shaltud, the one who is leading Al-Azhar University, officially announce Shia as the one of the official sects of the Islam. As I said, many activities by many ulama were preceding this incident, but we should acknowledge the role of Ayatollah Burujerdi regarding this incident as well, because of the relationship, because of sending representatives to Egypt.
This is important, that's right.
Yes, okay. He sent one of his
Saudi Arabia, Egypt, England,
yes, also
United
in order
States.
To prepare the situation. Yes. Prepare the situation. He has a very significant role in introducing Shia fiqh to Sunnis.
To Sunnis, that's right.
Because all these steps should be taken to reach to the level that someone like Sheikh Shaltud announced officially that Shia is regarded as one of the official sects of Islam. And also we see among his actions, he's sending representative to non-Muslim countries like Germany.
Yes.
So till now, the great or the Grand Mosque of Hamburg.
Hamburg, that's right, is
the place for all Muslims. At that time, it was the only place for Muslims, including Shia and Sunnis.
That's right.
So even they were aware of the policies to be taken in a way that you can bring about or you can bring all Muslims under one umbrella.
That's right.
As far as I remember, even nowadays, they would respect some of those issues, for example, for the Torba. Because one of the things that they would apply over there, even for Shias, they wouldn't take any Torba with them. Why? Because the place of the sajda or prostration was made out of wood. So it was one of the policies to be taken by the representative, Ayatollah Burujerdi.
Yes.
For what? To make this unity. No Shia and neither Sunni would take anything as a Torba. So you would see all Shia and Sunnis standing in one line, not even having any difference in the place of their prostration and sajda.
Okay.
I mean, to put in any Torba.
Okay.
Only it was the sign.
But this sending representatives to the other parts of the world, even non-Islamic lands, in order to preach Islam and the Shia Islam and make a kind of, we can't say dialogue, This establishment of the dialogue, and it's called the dialogue. This is important. Not the challenging political opposition, no. A kind of, it's called a dialogue based on, we can say, it's called a knowledge and discussions, was really a nice achievement. And we talked about some of the representatives of the late Ayatollah like Mahdi Hariri Yazdi and also Allah Muhammad Taqi Qummi, you know, in our previous discussions, that they were the establishers of the dialogue or Taqrib Bain al Mazahib al Islamiyya all across the world. Also, as you said, his discussions with Sheikh Shaltut and introducing Jafari Shia school of thought as an official school of thought inside the Islamic world was really a nice achievement of the late Ayatollah Burujerdi. Politically speaking, he was active too, isn't it, against the Pahlavi regime and Reza Shah?
Yes. In a sentence, if I want to introduce the personality of Ayatollah Burujerdi, I should say that this marja is an international and also is interfaith. And he is not considering the issues of religion only as a Shia scholar or as a person who just wants to focus on his scholarly activities only.
Yes.
So that's why he takes part in political issues.
Yes.
He defends those figures who are standing against oppressors. And also, another important point that I should mention is regarding the Salatul Jama'ah in Masjid al-Haram. That at that time, there were four Salatul Jama'ah in Masjid al-Haram held by different imams from four schools of thought of Ahlus Sunnah. I mean, Hanbali, Shafi'i, Imami, and Maliki schools of thought.
Okay.
And this was sending, not a good picture from Islamic school of thought to non-Muslims. That's why great Ayatollah Burujerdi sends a letter to them and asks them to have a collecting Salatul Jama'ah all together. And from that moment on, we see that Salatul Jama'ah in Masjid al-Haram is performed collectively and in a single turn.
So he had influence on the Sunni world too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because of the connections that he had, he did this best service to Muslim Ummah. So that's why I say that he was not thinking only about, you know, Shia school of thought, but he was thinking about Muslim Ummah.
That's
why he broadened his horizon, and this is very important.
His opposition against Baha'ism and also, we could say, Zionism.
Yeah.
And he was a pro-Palestine marja, you know, and his protection from the Palestinians, you know, was really outstanding. So politically, he was really active too. Really a comprehensive marja who was residing in Iran and the holy city of Qom, but his messages were passing over all across the world. And this is the time that we do not have, for example, I don't know, emails or something like that, or we can say the social networks or the social media. But the message and the true message of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Ahlul Bayt, main teachers of Islam and the Shia Islam, Ayatollah Burujerdi, gets all around the world and is spread all across the world. This was really outstanding. So, Sheikh Mahdavi, any other details about the life of Ayatollah Burujerdi?
I think beside all of these, we have to acknowledge his morality as well. Because always this part of the life might be marginalized, but it was one of the crucial part of the life of the great ulama. So, for example, only I want to bring up one example. I'm sure that our listeners, they will acknowledge his emphasis regarding the ethics compared to this example. It is said that he was trying not to get angry, and he had made this vow that if I get angry, I will fast 1 year. Is it understandable for us? It's really difficult. So it happened that once he got angry and he fast the whole year. As a compensation.
He abided by his promise?
Yes. So it shows
really
that, yes, he was really moral man. He was, as Ayatollah, marhum Ayatollah Gulpayegani is narrating, he had the wish of becoming martyr. He was always saying that, once I had this chance to become martyr, referring to that incident that he was arrested because of the opposition against Reza Shah, but I didn't. So he was always feeling pity for himself that why I didn't get martyr. So it shows that our ulama, they had this emphasis and focus and concern on morality and ethical issues for the life as well.
That's all right. The late Ayatollah Sayyid Hussein Burujerdi passed away on Shawwal 13, 1380, according to the lunar Hijri calendar. His body was taken into the vicinity of Masjid al-Azam, you know, and also the Holy Chamber and the Holy Shrine of Lady Fatimatul Masuma in the city of Qom, and he was buried over there. A very big, big burial procession was done for him, and Muhammad Hassan Tabatabai Burujerdi, the son of the Ayatollah, did the burial prayer in his body. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding comprehensive marja of the whole Islamic world, Sayyid Hussein Tabatabai al-Burujerdi. And thank you, Sheikh Zainia.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahdavi for your presence in the program, The Teacher. And thank you, much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Considering the latest controversies around Johnson, the British Prime Minister seems to be taking full advantage of a strategy known as the dead cat strategy in order to divert media attention away from problems or failures in other areas. Just a week after the vote of confidence, the British Prime Minister and his government are provoking other crises. Johnson says he wants to focus on what the people of the country want. And the first two issues which he has decided to tackle are the controversial matters of changing trade rules for Northern Ireland and flying refugees to Rwanda, both cases that thrust Britain into a nasty web of legal disputes that risk making the country look like an international scofflaw. With his leadership in peril, Johnson summoned his trusted advisors, and among those experts is political strategist Linton Crosby, a master of so-called wedge issues that divide national opinion. Such strategies are typically used to galvanize working-class voters. The most divisive wedge issue is asylum seekers, as Crosby clearly demonstrated in his experience with the Australian premiership, winning him many victories some two decades ago. So it wasn't a coincidence that a few days after their meeting, Home Secretary Priti Patel's floundering plan to export asylum seekers to Rwanda was revived. But at what cost has the British Prime Minister risked turning the UK into a pariah?
The controversy surrounding it is becoming more of a legal battle. We have seen the European Court of Human Rights intervening in the issue based on, you know, filing from some of those affected by the decision, some of the asylum seekers. And I wonder if the UK really became a pariah state under Mr. Johnson, because this is not the first time he is going against international law.
The chartered Boeing 767 booked to take asylum seekers to Rwanda was a fiasco. It didn't take off thanks to a last-minute intervention from the European Court of Human Rights. The British government's first attempt of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda came to a halt on Tuesday after the European Court of Human Rights intervened and forced the UK to abandon the flight. The intervention has, however, drawn frustration from British ministers who insist the plan was lawful. Britain's failed attempt has also led to officials proposing alternatives that would allow the UK to ignore the ECHR. Johnson himself defended the plan, saying it was completely legal.
Every single court in this country said, you know, there was no obstacle that they could see. Nobody in this country, no court in this country, ruled the policy unlawful, which was very, very encouraging.
Johnson described the order by the European Human Rights Court to stop the scheduled deportation of a handful of migrants as a weird last-minute hiccup. The United Nations refugee chief has, on the other hand, called it catastrophic. Following the ECHR's decision, British courts now have to clarify whether this practice is lawful.
When it comes to the issue of asylum seekers being exported by his government out of the UK to the to Rwanda, 1,000 miles away in Africa, that's actually illegal. We have heard this characterization of the issue as illegal from the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission, from multitude of international rights.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his government have spent much of this week battling with the EU and rowing with the European Human Rights Tribunal while playing down accusations that they are breaking international law and bow to the base of his party. On Monday, Johnson's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss revealed the long-awaited Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, a bill which, if passed, would allow the UK government to unilaterally cancel parts of the Brexit deal he struck with the EU in 2019. 2 days later, the EU reacted by launching legal action against the UK for its failure to implement parts of the protocol to date, while the Vice President of the European Commission stated that there is no legal or policy justification whatsoever for unilaterally modifying an international agreement. That is illegal. But the Prime Minister's willingness to have public spats with large international institutions seems typical of him. The Rwandan deportations and the renewed issue of Northern Ireland just seem to be radicalization of British politics, where Johnson tries to stay in power with new crisis. Russian President Vladimir Putin has lambasted the West, stressing that the so-called golden billion countries still pretend that they are superior and consider other countries to be their colonies. He, however, stated that the West's ruling elites live in a dream world and refuse to see global changes. Putin also accused Western countries of deliberately undermining the foundations of international order to satisfy their geopolitical illusions.
I think Putin's legacy will be in ushering in the end of American hegemony and the start of a unipolar world, helped in no small part by President Xi Jinping of China. The end of American hegemony will be mourned by a very small clique of nations that call themselves the international community. In reality, the international community is America and its client states. China, Russia, India, and much of the Islamic world don't take part in the shared narrative that is suggested by the term of the international community.
The Russian president stated that over the past decades, new powerful centers have been formed on the planet and are growing. He added that each of these countries has developed its own systems and also stressed that they have the right to protect themselves to ensure their national sovereignty.
It's obvious that the rules, the essence of the new world order, will be set by strong sovereign states which do not move along the trajectory drawn by somebody else. Only strong sovereign states can say their word in this emerging world order. Otherwise, they're doomed to become or remain rightless colonies.
Moreover, the Russian president said that the European Union has completely lost its political sovereignty, and its bureaucratic elites are dancing to someone else's tune, accepting whatever they're told from above, causing harm to their population and their economy. Putin slammed the EU's decision to impose sanctions on Russia as not well thought out, stating that the bloc's policies have delivered a serious blow to their own economies. The Russian leader says Western nations sought to use sanctions to crush the Russian economy by destroying logistics chains and hitting the Russian industry, finance, and living standards, but they failed to accomplish their goals. He added that the move has boomeranged, exacerbating the social and economic crisis across the West, especially in Europe.
Well, American imperialism has never been very good at seeing two steps in front of itself. Due to the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia, they've actually hurt themselves equally, if not more, than they have Russia. Since these sanctions have been imposed on Russia, Russia has managed to earn over 100 billion in fossil fuel exports. The ruble has now bounced back to be 30% stronger than it was at the beginning of the year compared to the dollar. And these sanctions that America have imposed have caused a fuel crisis all over the world. This has caused huge problems as a detrimental effect on the agriculture of the world, which is now risking a food crisis.
In light of the West sanctions and the move backfiring, the US and many countries in Europe are experiencing record high inflations. Hence, the move has led to the average citizen paying the price of what Putin called decisions divorced from reality and taken contrary to common sense. Apart from inflations as high as 20%, the EU could also lose billions of dollars as a direct result of the sanctions. Moreover, the West policies and sanctions also seem to be responsible for worsening global food insecurity, as they're hindering many nations' attempts of helping those in need. In his speech, Putin noted that the sanctions on Russia, particularly those on fertilizer and grain, have stopped the country's exports and are one of the reasons for the global food insecurity. He also warned that if there is famine in the world's poorest countries, it will be entirely on the conscience of the US administration and the European bureaucracy. The US has so far led a foreign policy that is mainly comprised of hostile approaches against any nation that doesn't play by its rules. And the West not allowing for aid exports from Russia is only another example of its controversial policies. These hostile policies are clearly demonstrated by the US's rising tensions with China, which followed Washington's adventurism in Taiwan. Russia, which was faced with sanctions after Moscow followed the country's national interests, and Iran, which is subject to Washington's economic warfare. The US-led moves have, however, only resulted in target nations prospering and becoming stronger under the failed Western policies.
A new report by the Wall Street Journal reveals that Israel secretly coordinates with the US on many of the airstrikes it carries out in Syria. The report adds that since 2017, Israel has carried out more than 400 airstrikes in Syria and other parts of the West Asia region. It claims that Israeli attacks have been aimed at restricting Iran and its allied forces in Syria. The vast majority of those Israeli airstrikes have